Yes, this is class number seven, and it's December 12th, 2022. I thank Mike. I'm still getting emails about the whole umbrella situation, and I actually found a tshuva today just randomly because I was looking at a new volume of tshuvot. His name is Rav Eliyahu Abergel. He's now based in Jerusalem. We mentioned him before. He's very liberal in certain areas. He actually writes about the Shabbos umbrella and he opposes it for more of the reasons we saw, but the non-pure halachic reasons. But I thank you, Mike, for sending me something from a mechaber I never heard of, Rafal Tzvi Weber of Neve Yaakov, in which he deals with umbrellas. He quotes the Chazon Ish that it's and then he says, and this is an important point, which although he's not one of the most famous Mechabrim, I think this is shared by many others. He says that when it comes to we're talking about something that the it's accepted that it's forbidden, even though the reason is not clear. Quote, Davar zed niten l'gdol Yisrael esar. That basically we can talk all we want, back and forth. Is it uvdu d'chol? At the end of the day, it's given to the Gedol Yisrael who make that decision, and that's why it might not make sense to us, because it's not only logical. And you'll have Gedolim who say one way and say another way. I think it's more intuitive, and either you buy into the system and you accept it, or you don't. So you might be wondering, we saw last class, what makes a Shabbos umbrella uvda d'chol, as opposed to wearing a hat, or as opposed to putting on a belt, or carrying a talus bag. And it's a, I think they would say uvda d'chol because we haven't done it for a long time. So you could say, well, you're right, but that doesn't refer to the Shabbos umbrella that it's a little open on the top. So there's no question of OL. And others will say differently. It's about changes. Anytime there's changes, it's a problem. I only have one more thing to do before we get right into it. There's so much I still want to do. I had a correspondence with one of you, and you asked, Frankl did certain reforms. We mentioned some, and there's a couple more I'll mention. I also want to speak about Rav Israel Hildesheimer's attitude towards him. For example, we spoke about that he wanted to get rid of piyutim and other things. So the question was, well, why didn't this create the controversy? I stress that the controversy was only dogmatic, and that's what we saw. It has to do with what is Torah Shebaal Peh. We'll see more of that today. Why weren't people attacking him for his reforms? But as I said, again, you can go back and listen. First of all, Hirsch also did reforms like that, but reforms have a context. In the early 19th century, getting rid of piyutim was terrible, a terrible reform. By the mid-19th century, people, because it wasn't being done by the traditionalists, and Frankl was a traditionalist in a reformist sentiment, it didn't create so much controversy. And I mean, he also, by the way, said you can get rid of mitzitza, which was an issue also with other even Orthodox rabbis. But I want to share something with you, because after I sent that email, I thought of something else to give you another good example. I've given some examples, but another example of how reforms only depend on the context and on the time. And I'll be curious to hear what the listeners have to say about this, if you regard this as a reform or not. There was a significant rabbi of his day, not one of the Gedol Yisrael, and here is his picture. His name was Rav Baruch Yitzchak Lifshitz. Looks like a frum Jew. He's the son of the Tiferes Yisrael, the famous Yisrael Danzig of no Lifshitz. Sorry, Rav Yisrael Lifshitz of he was rabbi in Danzig. He's the author of Tiferes Yisrael, the commentary on the Mishnah, the
Some
famous
kind of
commentary.
trouble to them.
And one of the great Gedolim. By the way, his son, who we just saw his picture, was the one who published the Mishnayos, the Tiferes Yisrael in the Mishnayos. And if you look, and if you look in the introduction to the son, he tells you that whenever you see Aleph Bet Yud, Aleph Bet apostrophe Yud, that refers to him. That's his, because he's Baruch Yitzchak Lipschitz, and he has certain comments. and a big Talmud Chacham. By the way, if you look in the Wikipedia Hebrew entry on Rav Baruch Yitzchak Lipschitz, it's a very nice entry. I don't know who wrote this. Someone takes the time to put in recent scholarship. So kol hakavod. Incidentally, it refers to in the entry, it refers to a letter that was sent to Rav Baruch Lipschitz that was published in Or Yisrael, the Hasidic journal Or Yisrael, urging him not, when he reprints the Tiferes Yisrael, not to include his father's work, the Drush Orach Chaim. Rav Yisrael Lipschitz has three controversial things. I mean, from our standpoint, I don't think they're controversial, but they were controversial in his day. The first is he has this passage, which I don't think is controversial as much as just really probably really wrong, is that he follows this notion that this legend that was repeated, which really goes back to Greek story. Schneider Lyman has a whole article on that Moshe Rabbeinu really was born with terrible traits. He wasn't kadosh from his birth, but he had terrible traits. And what makes him special is he was able to overcome these. And on the one hand, you can say, well, this is a great Musar teaching, but there's something improper about talking Moshe Rabbeinu, all these bad. I mean, you can look at him and you can see that he had these bad traits. Today, there's two Tiferes Yisraels, one that has it and the one that was taken out. The other controversy in the Tiferes Yisrael is, I think it's in the beginning of Baba Metzia, he quotes from Menashe of Ilya. From Menashe of Ilya is a Talmud of the Vilna Gaon, a Gaon in his own right, and he gave an explanation of the Mishnah at odds with the Gemara, that issue we've been speaking about, and Tiferes Yisrael quotes it. So there are people who said that has to be cut out. And the third thing is the Drush Orach Chaim. The Drush Orach Chaim is this whole long piece of Tiferes Yisrael explaining that they were after when they started uncovering dinosaur bones. So what are you supposed to do about it? They hadn't yet come up with the idea, which is a Christian idea, which then is adopted by the Lubavitcher Rebbe. I don't know if he adopts it knowing it's from, I mean, if he heard about it from the Christians or he came out independently, that all these fossils are just to test our faith. I guess fossil fuels also, but I mean, the fossils are just, were placed there to test our faith. Okay, that's not something, unless you're a chassid of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, you're not going to find this at all appealing. So Rav Yisrael Lipschitz says we already have traditions about worlds. The Gemara mentions worlds that were created and were destroyed. And he says, so that's what we're seeing. When we see the dinosaur bones, we're seeing remnants of earlier worlds. Okay, so why do I mention Rav Baruch Lipschitz? Because there's something else that has to do with reform. Now, again, I'm going to show you his picture. Hardly looks like a reformer. In fact, he was a candidate for the rabbinate of Krakow, and he loses out to the Chassam Sofer's son, Rav Shimon Sofer. So what's the reformist, or at least it's claimed to be reformist thing going on? Well, his father, the Tiferes Yisrael, wanted to push him into a rabbinate. And which rabbinate? The rabbinate of the city that he was born in and grew up. It's called Vernik. It's next to Posen, which is right next to Rabbi Akiva Eger's town, which is why we'll see where Akiva Eger gets involved. And the problem was that the son was not married. The man I just showed you, who incidentally later on we're told he gets a PhD, and he leaves the rabbinate and he sits and learns all day with talis and tefillin all day. Pretty incredible. So he's a young bacher. He's not married yet. Maybe he's 18. I don't know, because they got married pretty young. And his father is trying to get him set up as the rabbi of the town that he grew up in, because they have a rav. And Rabbi Akiva Eger, who's from Posen, who's in the area, is very upset with this and launches strong opposition. You could see this in the Igros Sofrim of Rabbi Akiva Eger, which is the letters of the Sofer family, Chassam Sofer, his son, grandson, including Rabbi Akiva Eger, because Rabbi Akiva Eger, although he's only, I think, 2 years or 3 years older than the Chassam Sofer, is his father-in-law, not by the Chassam Sofer's first marriage. So if you look at letters 31 and on, you see Rabbi Akiva Eger is very upset and says, we cannot have this. The fact that he knows the family and all this, he says, I'm not going to stop. I'm not going to rest until this ends. There's no way that your son can become Rav of a city. They said, especially not this city they grew up in. No one's going to respect him. They remember him when he was a little twerp. You think they're going to respect him? And he says, And in the middle, he says of his letter, his first letter, he has a few different letters. He says as follows. He says, I'm going to do as said, Masha Bekochi Levatelza. He says, I'll do whatever I can to make sure your son does not become rabbi. But in the middle of it, he says that if we allow him to become rabbi there, Yitzmachu Mizeh Kilkulin Rabin, this will lead to many problems. And because other communities will see this, and they'll also take rabbis like this, young rabbis, as we've seen elsewhere, Bavarseno Harabi. Now, this is cited by various people, including in the Wikipedia entry, as referring to the fact that the reformers will see that, hey, we can, you know, the old-time rabbis are on our side, but the young rabbis are on our side. We can push through young rabbis now into communities. And if that's what it means, that's interesting just to think about. I'll get back to in a second this idea of unmarried rabbis. So that there would be an example of something that depended on the circumstances. An unmarried rabbi, it would lead to reform, so you have to oppose it. I just mention that because it's a point that's made by a number of people, but I don't know if it's correct. I don't actually think so, because this is talking in 1833. 1833, really, you don't have reform rabbis. This is before Geiger. Even Holtheim is not known as a reformer. So I don't think that's what it's referring to there. I think it's just referring to that you'll have inexperienced rabbis, rabbis who won't be able to be leaders. But I mention it because it is given as an example of something, a fear that this would be a reform. Now, I wonder, is this a concern today, unmarried rabbis? I don't know. There are shuls that hire unmarried rabbis. I don't think the issue is the unmarried aspect as much as today shuls want things that they shouldn't be getting. What do I mean by that? 30 years ago, you came, you're a rabbi, you interview, and then they take you. You know, you come with your family, and that's where they take you. You could even be divorced. But today, what do the shuls want? They interview the husband and wife. And therefore, let's say your wife has a different career, or let's say she's not so learned. She didn't go to the GPATS program or something. The point is, they interview husband and wife, and the women expect the Rebbetzin to also give shiurim and be a spiritual leader. Okay, you might say, but that's okay, you might say. But on the one hand, I guess it is okay. But on the other hand, they're not paying the Rebbetzin. They're just saying, we're going to get two for the price of one. And they expect her to work. Problem number one. Problem number two. What about all the rabbis who are very good rabbis, but their wives just happen not to be Torah scholars of the sort they could teach? And that we never had that before. So I guess that doesn't bother me as much, because the community says we want a Rebbetzin to also give shiurim. That's their prerogative. But then you got to pay. This idea that you just expect that you're going to hire the husband and then the wife has to be there to do the bat mitzvah classes and to do all the other things. It's enough that she has to host all the different families. But to make her work, to expect that she's going to give shiurim and not pay? And I can tell you that goes on all over. That's not correct. So if we don't want to hire single men as rabbis or divorced men, I think it's more because of that. I don't think it's because of what Rabbi Akiva Eiger was referring to. And we're not so machmed today about single men as even Chazonim or Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. There used to be this idea that you're not supposed to hire them. Today, as far as I know, we're really not so machmed on it. Okay, let me take out my papers here. Oh, we have a lot as always to do. Hold on a second here. I am looking for my papers here, and you know what? I'm going to. I don't see what happened to it. Maybe I threw it out by mistake. So I'm going to read from my. I have my computer here, other computer here, and I could read from it while I'm speaking. Or you know what I might want to do? Actually, even better. I think I might even just print out. We're so casual here. I'll print out. That'll make it easier. I think I'll just print out the pages that I need as we're speaking, and then. But wait till you see the good stuff we have today. Hold on. So let me see where I am here. Okay, I'll see. I'll print out one page at a time, see how far we get. Okay, if you remember, we went through the Hirsch's criticism and Fischer's criticism of Frankl. And at the end, you know, that really, where's the Tourischeval pair? We'll see Frankl's final comment, where his final defense, and we'll see if you buy it or not. But after finishing with that, it's printing here, just wait a second. After finishing with that, this is 18, his book is published in 1859, 1816, 1861. You have the strong attacks on him. And by the end of these attacks, really, Frankl is not regarded as part of the Orthodox community anymore. He's regarded as part of the conservative camp later on, even the right-wing conservative, I guess you could say. In fact, today, let me show you something here. If you go to Potsdam near Berlin, you will find there is a school. Here it is. I'll pull it up here on my computer, my other computer here, so I see it well. Zacharias Frankl College. So that's really his legacy. And as we've seen a number of times, the issue, you know who's in charge of this here? Look who's the leader. Bradley Shavit Artson. He's also the head of the conservative seminary out in Los Angeles. So I don't know how often he comes, or but it's a small seminary, it is a seminary. There's a reform seminary as well. Now we've seen that the issue was not was dogmatic, was not dogmatic. Sorry, it was yes, was dogmatic. It was not halachic. And we saw already that Frankl was very strict when it came to halacha. He was we saw that he wouldn't carry even like when it came to the Eruv, he's very strict, stricter than many of the old time rabbis. Incidentally, I learned over Shabbos that Shaul Lieberman was also very strict about the Eruv. Where do I get this from? What do I mean? There's this booklet I have for this Growing Up Conservadox. David E.Y. Sarna, the son of Nachum Sarna, brother of Jonathan Sarna. He grew up at the seminary. His father came there and was a librarian. He taught there. And he says as follows. This is very relevant because of our Lieberman classes. But if you look on page 30, he tells us, no, sorry, not 30. First, we'll get to 30. 32, that there's a Manhattan Eruv. Now, we have people on Manhattan listening. I don't know. There's also a current Manhattan Eruv. If you just Google it, you'll see it. And all the Orthodox shuls, the modern Orthodox shuls, are signed on to this, and it's under the hashgacha of a group in Muncie. And it goes up to like 130th Street, includes Central Park. I don't know how or even if this differs from the old Manhattan era that goes back to the late 1950s. And it was really the brainchild of Menachem Kasher. And it had Gedolim, many Gedolim who supported it, others who didn't. You know, Rav Moshe and Rav Aaron Cutler didn't support it, but you had others. Rav Henkin, I believe, supported it. And so I don't know if anyone from Manhattan knows the difference about if they're really the same Erev or not. I assume by now there's been it's been updated and improved. But on page 32, David Sarna tells us that Lieberman never held of the Erev, the Manhattan Erev. Quote, he went so far as to have gold cufflinks made up that encased a working gold watch, so that there was no doubt that it was a tachshit. And he had a gold tie bar. Remember those tie bars? So the key was attached, was a tie bar. And so I found that interesting. By the way, in this little booklet, or not a booklet, a printout, there's also something of interest, I think, to you, that on page 30, it speaks about he's quoting Susanna Heschel. Remember, he grew up, David Sarna grew up with Livni's kids and Heschel's daughter and the whole group there. We have someone who listens to the classes who also grew up in that chevre. He's the one who took the picture I showed you of Lieberman on Hoshana Rabbah. Susanna Heschel told the story. She wrote it up, and then she added stuff in an email to Sarna that when she was ready to become bat mitzvah, she wanted to have a bat mitzvah. And Heschel invited Finkelstein over Shabbos afternoon, and Susanna Heschel says that she began by asking Finkelstein, I think he pronounced actually Finkelstein, about his commitment to civil rights, which he described with great pride and conviction. So Heschel, Susanna said, since you believed in equal rights for blacks, you must also believe in equal rights for women. I want to celebrate my bat mitzvah on a Shabbos morning at the synagogue. And what did Finkelstein say? Nope, just make a party at your home. And she says that her father, Heschel, just sat and smiled. Then she tells us that he tells us that she told him that Finkelstein discussed it with Lieberman, because Lieberman lived in the same building as Heschel. And Lieberman would have none of it. Lieberman, under no circumstances, neither during the service or after service, would a woman be permitted at the seminary minyan to stand on the bima to address the congregation, kal vachomer, not to be called to the Torah, because it dishonors the community and is undignified. Look how far we've come. That today in the modern Orthodox shul, at least the ones I know, they always let girls get up and give Divrei Torah, but Lieberman wouldn't allow it. So what did they do? She tells us in the end, Heschel decided to make the bat mitzvah that his daughter wanted, and they did it in Anshei Chesed, you know, Anshei Chesed on the Upper West Side. They did it, and there was no organ or choir at the day, but they had a bat mitzvah there, and she talks about how there was a dilemma. What were the Sarnas supposed to do? Because Nachum Sarna himself was ordained by Yecheskel Abramsky. And how can he go against Lieberman's psak? So they made a compromise that the Nachum Sarna and David Davina JTS and his mother and brother, who wasn't yet bar mitzvah, they went to Anshei Chesed. Very interesting.
I just
Since I'm just to mention the seminary, and we're going to talk later, I'll talk about the seminary in Breslau and the teachers they had there, because it was very much like JTS. You had teachers who, by any stretch of the imagination, would be regarded as Orthodox, and then you had teachers who were not Orthodox. You had the same thing, of course, as we know, in Manhattan. But he discusses, Sarna discusses this individual. Some of you old timers in New York might remember him, Rabbi Kret. Who dies in 90, he dies, no, he dies, he retired in 97. He died about 2007, I believe. You can look it up. 2007, at 100 years old. He gave the hashgacha on the restaurant at the seminary, the cafeteria. And everyone ate at the cafeteria at the seminary. And it wasn't just because, you know, the conservatives, at least that they held by, it was always under Orthodox hashgacha. So everyone ate there. But not only that, he also was a tutor, a Talmud tutor. He was employed, the seminary paid him, and he would give, he was like the, I don't know what you call it, like the guy you have in the Beis Medrash, the Sholem Yeshiv. Yeah, so his job was to help the students, teach them Talmud, and he did that, Sarna tells us, with the permission of Rabbi Henkin. And but he would never, you know, he wasn't an official member of the faculty. Okay, so I'm sure this brings back memories for some of you. One more thing I want to mention. Oh, let me print out another page here, because we're getting onto the next page here. Never done this before, where I think I threw it out by mistake. I was cleaning up my desk here. Actually, maybe it's on my desk. I was cleaning up my desk here. I must have thrown it out by mistake. So I'll print down another page. Darchei HaMishnah appears in 1959. Now, I do want to mention one thing to you. Our grammarians might find this of interest. So it's all about the Mishnah. It goes through, especially it's about the different, if you have any question about one of the Tanaim, you can, and there's other things. I'll read you other things about it in the future as well. But right at the beginning, page, page seven, and then I'm looking now in the Warsaw. It was reprinted again in Warsaw in the 30s. By the way, it was edited by Revizak Nissenbaum. Revizak Nissenbaum was a big Darshan, an Orthodox Darshan, and he edited it, unless there's another Yitzhak Nissenbaum. Right at page seven, he asks, well, how do you pronounce the word? Is it Mishnah or Mishneh? And I thought, obviously, it's Mishnah. Who would ever say Mishnah? But lo and behold, I went online, I Googled it. Take a look at this. Hold on. Oops, I thought I... I do want to show you. I should show you because you'll find this interesting. What could I hear? Now, you might, I think many of you are probably also wondering. I got to share the screen with you again here. It's obviously Mishnah. But look, here you have Torah Org from Refran, the Mishnah states, the Shulchan Aruch Harav site. Mishnah states, or EDU, is that, or Sameach, the Mishnah states, Eishet Torah, the Mishnah states, even Solomon Zeitlin, the Mishnah states, Rabbi Jachter, the Mishnah states, and it goes on and on and on. So what is it? Is it Mishnah or Mishneh? If you look at the Aruch gives both of these as an option. What would be the meaning of it? Mishnah is like from the word shinun, to teach, and Mishnah would be second. So, for example, repetition, Mishnah Torah, second to the Torah. But he says it has to be Mishnah because don't we say Mishnatenu? And he says it's no question that it's. Mishnah, not Mishneh, but the Aruch gives both options. I want to tell you before I go on in Darchei Mishnah, I want to tell you what I just explained to you that the attacks of Gottlieb Fischer and Hirsch, and I'm going to give you another individual. We have grandchildren, not grandchildren, great 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 grandchildren of him, at least from two sides. I don't even know if they know each other, cousins of another individual, Rav Shlomo Zev Klein, who also attacks Frankel. I want to give examples of that as well. But these attacks, as I just mentioned, had the result that Frankel was really no longer, by let's say 1870, he's no longer regarded as a typical, or as an Orthodox rabbi. He's regarded as, form, something else in the middle. But until then, I think for the Hirschians, this is an important point, that it was really Hirsch in his journal and Gottlieb Fischer that exposed Frankel for who he was, so he was no longer accepted as part of the Orthodox world, although he does continue to be quoted and given respect by many Orthodox figures. I think their assumption is that it's these people don't really know that much about Frankel, they haven't investigated it, but really he's, by 1870, he's no longer part of Orthodoxy. But in 1860, you can see that he would have been regarded as, he did things that are maybe a little controversial. So for instance, he disputes the Chasam Sofer. There's a certain rabbi named Alexanderson that the Chasam Sofer apostled, and Frankel said he basically should be given another chance, that sort of thing. But he was a Rav in Dresden, and he would have been regarded as an Orthodox, until the Darchei Mishnah was written. He really would have been regarded as a traditionalist rabbi. And I'll give you an example of how we see this very clearly. A halachic issue arose and a question came up that Frankel becomes one of the people questioned about it in a way that wouldn't have happened 10 years later. What happens? Well, a halachic question arises in New Orleans in the United States in 1860, and they wanted an answer, and they wrote to four great rabbis in Europe, what we today will call modern Orthodox rabbis in Europe. Now, why did they write to four? Why not write to one? Maybe they were shopping for a heter. Maybe they thought that the others wouldn't answer them. It's always a question what it means when you write to more than one rabbi. It could be. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with it. Let's say they write to a few different rabbis, and one of them, they get back letters, let's say from a few of them who are aser it, or forbid it, and one permits it. Then I guess they're within their rights to choose the one that permits it, but maybe, and even if not, they can certainly ask the ones who forbid it and say, I guess you're not supposed to ask more than one, but you can ask, is it okay if we rely on the other? Like if you go to a rav, let's say, you have a really complicated question, a difficult question, a lot of money is involved, and you go to him, and he says, I can't be moderate. I can't find a way to permit it. You can ask the Rav. There's nothing wrong with asking the Rav that, is it okay if I go ask another Rav? Maybe this posek can come up with a solution. And we do this all the time with questions of Mamzerus and Aguna. I don't think any posek would have a problem. I think they would say, well, if he can find a heter, he's a reliable posek, then he could. And we know that there have been poskim, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, in difficult cases of abortion, we know that he was sent people to the Tzitz Eliezer because he said that although I hold differently, he's a reliable posek and you're within your rights. If you want to ask in the shul and rely on him, you can rely on him. So that they write to the four who were regarded as, I guess you would say, modern Orthodox. Now, who are these four that they wrote to? They wrote to Nathan Marcus Adler, Chief Rabbi of England, Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch, Rav Shlomo Yehuda Rappaport of Prague, and Rav Zacharia Frankel. So the fact that the American Jewish community in New Orleans, or the Orthodox community in New Orleans, and looking for four enlightened Orthodox rabbis, those were the ones they picked. Notice that Frankel is among them. That would not have happened 10 years later. So what's the question? By the way, the question, the details of this can be seen in a book. It's a two-volume book, but in one of the volumes by a man named, well, let me show you his picture. His name is Israel Joshua Benjamin. And while we're doing this, I'm actually going to print the next page that I need, so I'll have it handy. Sorry about the noise that you hear. Israel Joshua Benjamin. Who is Israel Joshua Benjamin? He's a world traveler. He has the book I'm going to talk about now is 3 years in America, but he has 1 8 years in Asia. What he did is he left his wife. In those days, they would leave their wives. People would leave their wives for a year or two. He left her for many years. First, he went off to Asia. 8 years, but it was two trips. And he left a amazing memoir. Here, I have it. It was reprinted. 8 years in Asia and Africa from 1846 to 1855. What type of adventures he had? I don't know if they're all true, but he's in his Talmud Chacham also. I was particularly interested in page 327 because he repeats something which I've told you before. He says in Africa, and he went all over Africa, as well as in Asia, the women do not come to the synagogue. They're only present for circumcisions, except for some old women who attend. But he describes. It's also an amazing book for a different reason. Look, he's describing his adventures in America, the people he meets, and also America. It's not the Tocqueville. I'm not going to say that. But you get a good description of life in America and his impressions. He meets Brigham Young. He goes to Utah and meets the Mormons. And the Mormons have just, they're very new. And his descriptions, oh, let me read you this. His descriptions of the Mormons. Volume 2, page 224. He tells us he spent an hour with Brigham Young at 64 years of age. He says that I couldn't inspect his harem. In this respect, I felt like I was back on the continent of Asia, for I could no more get to see the ladies of the house in Utah than in the Orient. And he tells us that he saw lots of kids of Brigham Young. And he says that he has 13 wives. Well, he's a little bit mistaken there because Brigham Young, I looked it up today, Brigham Young had like 56 wives, and even in the time when he was there, he had he probably had like 30 wives. How he only had like 55 children, I don't know. But so he tells us about his visit to Brigham Young. So if you look in volume, that's volume two. In volume one, on page 320 and on, he tells us the whole story, and the Chuvot that he's going to cite are reprinted from the Occident. The Occident is was the traditional newspaper in America in the mid 19th century. I'm going to have to, with my new project, I'm going to have to go through all the old Occidents. They're all online right now. That's when you could see what was going on. First of all, you have the Orthodox Reform dispute there, and you have halachic issues in America. Incidentally, not in the Occident, but in another source that I'm not going to reveal because I found it, and this will be one of my discoveries I want to include in the book. There was actually discussion in the 1870s, as I recall, about Chol Yisrael in America, long before Rav Moshe Soloveitchik discussions of about Chol Yisrael and not. So what was the issue? Well, he tells us he's really responsible for this issue. He's in New Orleans. What's he doing in New Orleans? Well, again, he's visiting. He's going all over. And it's not long after Judah Toro dies. So here's a picture of, Judah Toro. You can read about him, a nice Wikipedia entry. Judah Toro lived in New Orleans for like 50 years, very philanthropic. We got the Toro Synagogue. He sent money for the cemetery and the synagogue there. Toro College is actually named after him and his father, Isaac Toro. I saw this. I wasn't sure, but if you go online, you see it's named after both of them. All I can say is that we are very fortunate that that for someone who lived in New Orleans for all this time, that Judah Toro was not a supporter of slavery. Or so we're told. Here's an article from the Jewish Encyclopedia where it says that although there were some Jews who were slaveholders, the alleged fact that they say that they allege that Judah Toro sanctioned slavery, but it's false. It says this rests on the false assumption regarding his attitude towards the institution. He evinced his anti-slavery views in no uncertain terms. For the Negroes who waited upon him in the house of the shepherds, with whom he lived for 40 years, were all emancipated by his aid and supplied with the means of establishing themselves. And the only slave he personally possessed, he trained to business, then emancipated him, furnishing him with money and valuable advice. The reason I say that's good news is, can you imagine in today's day and age if it turns out that Toro, and this is a rich guy in New Orleans, you'd expect him to have slaves. Had he had slaves, I think the pressure would be such that they'd have to change the name of the college. Again, I don't know how far back we go on this. My daughter's in Princeton. They got rid of Woodrow Wilson, and statues are falling. Even Abraham Lincoln's statue they want to take down because, oh, he freed the slaves, right? He didn't exactly have 21st conceptions about the equality of everyone's intellects, that sort of thing. But I don't know how far back you're going to take it. The Rambam believed in slavery. I mean, he writes about it in the Mishnah Torah. So I don't know how far back we're going to use our 21st century conceptions to try to apostle, I guess you could say, to try to delegitimize people in earlier generations. But Judah Toro died, and the community wanted to make a monument for him. And he describes here, Benjamin, that at the congregation Shari Chesed, one of the congregations that in New Orleans, he's told that the Portuguese congregation, there was a Portuguese congregation in New Orleans, had in New Orleans, there was a Portuguese synagogue there, that they wanted to memorialize him by having a statue. You know, a statue, a big bronze or whatever statue of Judah Toro. That's think the Lincoln Memorial, think the Jefferson Memorial. That's what they wanted to do. And Benjamin, who I don't think is a rabbi, although he's a Talmud Chacham, he's very upset with this because He says that he told them that I've been all over the world. I've been on four continents. I know something about my fellow Jews. Nowhere did I see or find the statue of a Jew, because this is clearly against the principles of our holy religion. He wrote this originally in German. It was translated to English. And then he says that his words caused great excitement among the religious Jews, because these were Amoratzim, but they were pious. He had pious people, but not everyone is pious. In fact, some of the so-called Orthodox Jews, they supported, he describes, the statue, whereas in the Reform community, they opposed it, seeing that it's not in line with traditional Jewish notions. In fact, he says that this, one of the supposedly Orthodox people, the chazan and preacher of the Portuguese synagogue, who's Ashkenazi, actually, when he went to him, and he said to him that it's clear from halacha that a statue was forbidden. And what did this chazan say? In America, you didn't have many rabbis. At this time, I think you only had two rabbis in the entire United States in 1860. You had Bernard Illowy, who would come in 1861 to New Orleans. He's the rabbi I mentioned who was stuck there during the Civil War, and there was a Union blockade, so he couldn't get a srogin. So he ruled that you should use a lemon, but don't make a bracha on it, but just use the lemon so as not to forget the mitzvah. So you had him and you had Abraham Rice, buried in Baltimore. And from he wasn't only in Baltimore, but I don't believe you had another Orthodox rabbi in America at the time. So you had a lot of people who learned a little bit when they were in Europe. They come to America, they become preachers, chazanim, they called themselves rabbis. You had your fair share of charlatans also. So what did this chazan say? He says, that was in ancient times. Now, however, we live in the 19th century. Whereupon Benjamin says to him, if the world were twice as old as it is, our Torah would still be the same. To which the chazan said, that doesn't concern me. So then Benjamin tells the whole story, how he published in the local newspaper there, Cornerstone. I don't know if that's the Jewish newspaper or regular newspaper. He published his opinion, how this is completely inappropriate. It must be the Jewish newspaper, because he cites Yoredeya. It's stated expressly in Yoredeya that we may not make the portrait of a man in relief. And we find also in the Siftei Kohen, that's the Shach, that's prohibited to make a complete like this. So here you have Benjamin, the Talmud Chacham, telling them that this is insane. We don't make statues to memorialize someone. But then he mentions how people attacked him. So it's back and forth. Believe it or not, Isaac Mayer Wise, preacher of the Cincinnati Reformed Congregation, came out on his side. And not a single, except for this one person mentioned above, he says not a single Orthodox rabbi took his side. That must only be because Rice and Illowy didn't participate in this debate. But among the ones that were in the area, no one took his side. So what did they decide to do? Then the committee doesn't know what to do. You have Benjamin saying one thing, and then you have the others, the local preacher saying something. So that's when they decide to send it to the four rabbis. And what are the questions that they send? They first of all, they go into detail of how wonderful Toro is. He's actually, it says his remains were transferred to his family tomb in Newport, Rhode Island. And now here in New Orleans, because we don't have his grave, we want to make either a statue, bronze or marble, or some other monument, a shaft, pillar, a column, in honor of the deceased, provided this is not in conflict with the laws and usages as halacha de minhagim of Israel. So they write to these four rabbis, and here are the questions. One, can we make a statue in bronze or marble in some open place in the city in honor of a Jew? Two, if we can't make a statue, can we have a shaft, a column, or pillar? Think like a big pillar. I don't know why that would be such an honor of someone if you don't have a picture of, if you don't have the image on it, just a pillar. I guess you would say this is an honor. And then they ask other questions. Can Jews take part if the city, let's say, is building a monument, a statue for a non-Jew? Can we take part in that also? Or is this only about Jews? And then they say, this is the first time they heard about these halachot, it seems. They want to know, can a Jew be involved in sculpture? Can you make images? With nothing to do with idolatry, can you be, as a job, can you be hired to make sculptures and statues? And also, can you have in your house specimens of art such as statues or statuettes of human beings or of dragons or of other animals? Okay, good question. So on the major issue, can you make a statue for Judah Benjamin? All the Rabbanim say absolutely not. The first one is the letters were all in German except for Rappaport, Shears. His is in Hebrew, and he thinks this is totally insane that you're going to make a statue. Whoever heard of such a thing? He says this is what this takes us back. He says to the days of the Hashmonaim. He says hello. It's good to say it around Hanukkah time. He says, "No nirah kazos miyom hiskabru achashmonaim gamal rishay amenu misalim belilei hayavonim uvekibud psileihem." He says that this is taking us back. We haven't heard of anything like this. The Jews have any connection to idols since the days of the Hashmonaim, where they overpowered the wicked Jews who were worshiping at the Greek idols. And he says, and this Yetzer Hara that we're going to have a statue was thought to have been already carved in his spotlights on Israel. Who thought that Jews would ever have such a Yetzer Hara? And now people want to do it again to bring up from the dust and do it? Well, and this is how you're going to honor through a statue this Ish Chesed? It's very nice highfalutin language of Shear to say this, but it's not like the Jews, it's not like a Yetzer Hara to worship idols. That's not why they're doing it. It's not about idolatry. He's using hyperbole here, because there's absolutely no connection between the idols that the Hashmonaim battled against and what their purpose was and what they wanted for Judah Benjamin. But his point is that Jews have not had anything to do with idols since over 2,000 years ago in the days of the Maccabees, and now you're bringing back an idol. Then we have Hirsch's opinion. Hirsch's opinion, which is known because it's also in the volume of Responsa, he translated into Hebrew, the Shemesh Merapeh. And Hirsch says, again, that according to Jewish law, the erection of a statue of a human figure of bronze, stone, or any material is prohibited. Similarly, Jewish law prohibits the erection of a monument devoid of any images for divine worship. Now, what about the... what about if you just want to have a shaft, a statue, not of a person, but just like a shaft, a pillar? That's not so clear. Hirsch says that it's that the erection of stones as monuments for profane purposes is not prohibited by law. So Hirsch says you can set up a pihalacha pillar. But remember, Hirsch says then, you said in your mail to me, in your letter, that you want to know not only is it against Jewish law, but is it against the usages? That is Minhag Yisrael. And Hirsch says that if you look at our history, you see that although technically there's nothing wrong with setting up a pillar and saying that this is in memory of Judah Benjamin, this is not how Jews have done things. It goes against Minhag Yisrael, and therefore you should not do this, because you say you don't only want the laws, but you want the usages. And that is the Minhag Yisrael. So he says, let us preserve this Jewish custom, which means also to honor most the memory of the distinguished dead by the very refusal of the communist to Ein Nosin Nefashos L'Tzadikim. We don't set up memorial statues, things like that. And he says, until now, the only way we've done memorialize people was by good and useful works. You can give tzedakah in their name, that sort of thing. And there's nothing, traditional Judaism does not recognize anything valuable, salutary in setting up a statue like this. And he says that the amount of money it's going to cost you to set up this statue, you can use for tzedakah. Okay. Third answer is Rabbi Nathan Marcus Adler of London, chief rabbi. And he says the same thing, that that it's not lawful to erect a statue, but you can erect a column or a pillar, because the halacha is only pillars are erected for the worship of God. He doesn't say, unlike Hirsch, who throws in, but you shouldn't do it because it's not Minhag Yisrael. Adler doesn't say that at all. And Rappaport and Hirsch never answered the other questions, which Adler does, that it's not unlawful for Jews to subscribe or even take an active part towards the erection of a statue in honor of a distinguished non-Israelite. So, for instance, if we're going to set up a statue now in honor of a great non-Jewish leader, or let's say the Jefferson Memorial breaks and we want to rebuild it, there's no problem in doing that. And he says also not a problem for a Jew to devote himself to sculpture or graven images. It's not awful if you sculpture, if it relates to human images, the sun or the moon. But if you're doing other things, you make mountains or other, whatever you do, and just making pillars, that's not a problem. He also says it's not, al-pi halacha, you can't keep statues in your house of humans or images of the sun or of dragons or animals, however you can, except for not the Chayos HaKodesh. What are the Chayos HaKodesh? Take a look in Yechezkel, chapter 1, verse 11. They had four faces, human, eagle, bull, and a lion. And that's Adler. And finally, Frankl. Frankl, as the fourth of the, I guess, the enlightened, they're not writing to the Chassid Sof or anything. Well, he wasn't alive, but they're not writing for traditionalists. They're writing for the open-minded rabbis. And same answer you get from Frankl. In fact, Frankl says that we have this idea, Enos in the Fushal Tzaddikim, we don't make memorials, monuments for Tzaddikim, their words are their memorials. Frankl says that even tombstones were rarely erected in olden days. That then the days, let's say, of the sages, we didn't have tombstones. When were tombstones? We don't think we had tombstones, let's say, early Spain or anything like that. We do find some ancient tombstones, but not from like Second Temple times. What we have is in the catacombs, maybe because they're in the catacombs that we don't see it, but we do have the Jewish catacombs. By the way, there's Jewish catacombs in Tunis with menorahs that were there and everything. And my son is going with YU. There's a special group that's going to Rome in 2.5 weeks. And they're doing something which most people don't do because you need to get special arrangements, the catacombs in Rome, to go down and see where they buried the Jews. But did they have tombstones? We know that in many places in Europe, the church, the Christians did not allow Jews to have tombstones. But he says that in the past, they didn't do it because it wasn't considered important. I don't know if that's true, though. We have plenty of tombstones from medieval times, and they wouldn't have just invented it. And from talking from 2,000 years ago, that's not the sort of thing that really would survive. And in the catacombs, they clearly do have acid. They tell you who's buried there. So why, if they buried you in an open field, why wouldn't they put a tombstone? And then he says, he goes into details more historical. Kedarko b'Kodesh. He talks about when Alexander the Great entered Jerusalem and he treated the city with such kindness. No statue. The Jews never created a statue to honor Alexander the Great, because that's not what Jews do. What did they do? Frankl says they announced that in the following year, every male child will be named Alexander in honor of Alexander. And that's why the name Alexander becomes a kosher Jewish name. It's not considered a secular name. It's considered great rabbis were named Alexander. And then he talks about how Jews refused to receive the statue of Caligula in Jerusalem, and they protest, et cetera, et cetera. He goes on. Then he gets into halacha. Very clearly, quote Shulchan Aruch, the erection of a statue in honor of a Jew, as well as any other man, is prohibited by the Jewish religious law. So you can't establish it, and you can't build the statue of a Jew or a non-Jew. You can erect a shaft or a pillar. Now, the other question, can you be involved in if the non-Jews want to put up a statue, can you contribute to that? We already saw Rabbi Adler says yes. Frankl says, he quotes Tosos here, he quotes the Shulchan Aruch, to subscribe, that is to donate, is not prohibited, and you can take an active part. You just can't be involved in setting up the sculpture, but you can raise money, things like that. And what about work being a sculptor, manufacturing these things? The practice of the art of sculpture, comprising that of human beings, is prohibited. Of other beings, is not prohibited. The art of engraving is lawful. See Yoredeya. He's answering it just like any traditionalist rabbi. And then he says that you can keep specimens of art, but not in your house, but not statues of human beings. Unless you mutilate a nose or an eye, then you can put it in your house. I think that's significant because Adler, in giving his answer, just says it's not lawful for Jews to keep in their houses statues of human beings or any other images. Frankl, however, says you can't keep statues of humans, but if you chop off an eye or a nose, then you can. And we all know that's the halakha. Why Adler doesn't really give the halakha? He gives a no without giving the details. Frankl is more exacting on the halakha that you can, if you mutilate a little part of it, then you can. And finally, is it lawful for the Jews, they actually call them Israelites of New Orleans, to erect a statue or monument in honor of Judah Toro? Quote, Israelites of New Orleans can, conformably to the religious laws, by no means erect a statue to the late Judah Toro, either by themselves or in conjunction with the non-Israelites. The erection of a monument, however, such as a shaft, column, or pillar in honor of Judah Toro, is lawful and can be executed without scruple or hesitation. Signed, Breslau, July 19, 1860. Benjamin, right after quoting this, points out, however, shortly after this, the Civil War breaks out, and because of the Civil War, there was no one's building any monument to Judah Toro, and that's the end of that. But this is significant, I think, because it's really the last time that Frankl is seen together with the Rabbanim, and his opinion is valued just like the other Rabbanim. And you read his opinion is absolutely in accord with Halacha, even more exact than Nathan Marcus Adler, who doesn't point out that there are ways that you can have a human statue in your house. From here, I see it's already time. From here, we'll get back to Darchei Mishnah, because I have to give you Frankl's replies and a few other things we'll get to next class. In fact, I want to ask you. I want to show you some things that I think you're going to be surprised in terms of what certain Gedolei Yisrael have said about what we're often taught is Halacha Moshe Sinai. But we'll get to that a bit later. Rabbi Kelman says that tonight is Yud Tes Kislev. It's a chag. So Gershon, you mentioned the controversial Tiferes Yisrael story regarding Portrait of Moshe. Yes, and that's a story of a riff. You said this, a riff on one told by Aristotle. And you must have said that before I mentioned that. So you are machaven, as we say in yeshivas, to what I was going to say.
Mark, can you just tell me that story about Brigham Young? Was that Torah or Benjamin who met
No,
Brigham
Benjamin. Benjamin tells how he went to Salt Lake City. The Mormons are not,
Young?
they're a mid-19th century religion, and so he Brigham Young takes over after the founder of it, Joseph Smith, is killed, him and his brother, and
But
so he this is a
Benjamin
new
wasn't.
phenomenon. This is the only American really American religion which is so successful, and I guess it's not a cult, it's a religion, so we can't speak negatively of their ideas, but I mean, some of their ideas are really crazy, that the Israelites made it to America, and the whole the golden the I forget what you call them, the things, the Moroni, the gold plates and all this. I mean, it's a but people believe it, I guess. If it's your religion, that's what you believe.
But was there a Jewish influence?
I don't know if there's a Jewish influence. They've always had they seem to have a good connection to Jews. There are, believe it or not, 13 principles of the Mormon faith. So in fact, that's got to be an influence, I guess. But as far as I know, there's no influence from Judaism, influence from the Bible. And but some people can correct me if I'm wrong. The real issue is, are Mormons to be regarded as Christians? They regard themselves as Christians, but some do not regard them as Christians. They agreed, as I recall, that when they opened their institute in Jerusalem, they would not proselytize. Now, many people were very upset because they also proselytize dead people. That is, so when Jews started learning that they were taking our dead ancestors and converting to Mormonism, including Anne Frank, many Jews got upset. It never really bothered me, you know, that's their mishigas, that they're going to take my great-great-grandfather, you know, look in the population charts and find out and convert him to Mormonism. I don't know why Jews were so offended by this, but there were Jews who made a real stink about this. I guess Anne Frank, okay, I can see the Holocaust, people killed in the Holocaust, you don't want people converting them to Mormonism. But listen, we deal with this. I'm at a Catholic university, so Edith Stein's a big name. Edith Stein, born Jewish, becomes a Catholic nun and then is killed. I think it's, was it Auschwitz she was killed? I forget now. But she's regarded as a martyr. And so it's a big deal. Edith Stein, the martyr, but she's really not a martyr. She's not a martyr to the church. She was killed because she was Jewish. It has nothing to do with Catholicism. So it's a little bit annoying. But at the end of the day, if that's their shtick, that's their thing. Barry says that his grandfather told him that in the 40s in the Bronx, there was opposition to hiring a David Hollander, Mount Eden Jewish Center, because he was single. He got the job and eventually got married. Oh, that's interesting. I was looking this week. I was at the New York Public Library and I was looking at old newspapers, and there was material there about Rabbi Hollander when he was hired, although it didn't say anything about him being single. I'm not sure what was the reason, because they thought it creates, well, I don't know, temptation for a man being around women all the time, or just not appropriate. There was a time that divorce also was, they would say you shouldn't apply for the job, but there's been Rabbanim who've been divorced. I don't know. Nissen tells us that even though he's single, he lay in Yamin Noraim at a Chassidish Minyan in Borough Park. Nissen, I don't know if the issue is laning. No, as far as I know, no one mentions laning as an issue, because laning, everyone gets an aliyah. The issue is being the Baal Tefillah. But I can tell you 100% that I know of plenty of shuls, not the big, big shuls, but smaller shuls that need chazanim, that hire single people all the time. In fact, my son's a chazan. So I told him if he wants to make a few thousand dollars, he has to learn. He's in the Y studs. So he's making money doing Hanukkah concerts. But I said to him, I think he can make $5,000, right? Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, that he should learn Nusach, and then he can be hired and be a chazan.
Yeah, I did it for free. That may be why.
No, but it's not. It's a Baal Kori is not Baal Tefillah. So that's that wouldn't be the issue. Thomas said there's a great book produced by Yeshiva University Museum for his exhibits on Erev, which has detailed history of Matan Erev. I vaguely remember their initiatives in the early years of the 20th century. You have to get the book to see. That has also, Adam Mintz has an article on it. Well, yeah, well, there was an Erev going back with Yeshua Siegel. Yeshua Siegel was the Rav on the Lower East Side. He was the Rav of the Pelesha, the Polish Jews, the Pelesha. Yaakov Yosef was for the Litvox, but Yeshua Siegel, he even published a Kuntres. He set up an Erev. They used the, what do you call them? The raised trains, or I forgot what you call them. He used it as, so there was an Erev in Manhattan, but that was not the first. Before that, you had it in St. Louis, before you had it in Manhattan. So there were, but then they created the Manhattan Erev. Rav Kasher was very involved with this. The question I had is the new Manhattan Erev. You just Google it. You can see the map online. I did it because my son was going to be in Manhattan, Midtown, and I wanted to know where the Erev is. And it's not local rabbis. It's out of Muncie, and it's all the Orthodox shuls in Manhattan are all in on it. So, which is different, because the old Manhattan Erev, there were many people who didn't hold of it, didn't carry it. It was controversial. If here you have basically every single, all the big modern Orthodox shuls, it's like 25 shuls, maybe not even all modern, are all in on it. It seems that this is much more mekubal, much more accepted. When I lived on the Manhattan in the 98 to 2000, so there was a separate Erev on the Upper West Side, which everyone, as far as I know, everyone used. I know the Haredim used it. But then there was the Manhattan Erev. So I asked one of the Rabbanim, who remained nameless, a shul rabbi, does he use the Manhattan Erev? Because it's a big deal. Because you can go to Riverside Park, but you couldn't go to Central Park. And he told me as follows. He uses it b'tzina. That is, he holds of it, But he wouldn't carry, because I guess that means because people will see him and think he's not a from Jew. But he was being honest with me, telling me that he privately carries something, but he won't let people see. Now, and maybe that goes against Osaguru. I mean, if he holds it okay, maybe he should use it. And then people I know would say that they let their wives use it, but they wouldn't use it. I never exactly figured that one out. Okay. Nissen says that he's told that Rav Moshe was about to gavel in approbation from the hetnei of Rav Aaron arrived from Lakewood to Gush Rabbanim meeting, and Rav Moshe was forced to acquiesce. If you look at Rav Moshe's letter, Rav Moshe never says it's forbidden. He says that he himself does not hold of it, but there are many Gedolim who do hold of it. Contrast that to the Brooklyn Erev, where Rav Moshe says it's absolutely forbidden, and he protested it. Manhattan Erev, he never protested it. He simply says there's many big Talmid Chachamim who support it, but I'm not going to. I'm not sure the difference is why on Brooklyn versus Manhattan. Maybe it has to do with Ocean Parkway or other issues. And yes, Rabbi Kelman says that Rabbi Adam Mintz, who wrote his doctoral dissertation on the history of Erevin in modern times, is finishing his book on it, and he's going to give a series. But if you're going to have to wait till the book is published for the series, it might be a while, because this book has been in the production stage for a long, long time. But the dissertation is available online, and anyone can see it. And they were Erevin in... When the Boston Erev went up, I was in the Boston Rebbe Shul that Shabbos. For years, they didn't put it up because Soloveitchik was very strict and he opposed it. But after he was ill, he was still alive, but he was ill, they put up the Erev, and the Boston Rebbe stood up and said, everyone must hold it or should hold this Erev. And Erev is not a new thing. That we all in Europe, they always had Erev and they needed it because they had to go to the communal oven. Those who come with us to Tunisia, you'll see they have an Erev around Gerba and they still have a communal oven, where everyone puts their chalent in and they go pick it up, just like in the old times. So you always had Erevin in the small towns. The question only was in the big cities, did you have Erevin? And Rabbi Mintz, in terms of announcements, Budapest was supposed to have an Erev. Mass Pesach, that's big for those who are traveling. But I can announce that I was in Florida a couple weeks ago, and the Chabad rabbi in Jupiter, Florida, told me that in 2 weeks, so that's this week, there will be an Erev in Jupiter, Florida. Now, unlike Palm Beach Gardens, Jupiter just has a very, very small religious community. So I guess he's hoping that this will now bring an influx of, since everyone's moving to Florida, you can move to Jupiter. Well, thank you, Rabbi Kelman, for providing the link. And Ellie says, I went to school with Rabbi Kretz's daughter. He was very medoctic and got all people interested in Judaism. Rabbi Henkin told him, according to Sorna, that by him being at the seminary, being like this Gemara tutor, it's not that they're going to influence him, that he will influence them. And Rabbi Shunau says, Rabbi Lieberman wore his handkerchief to not allow women to dance with the Torah and simplest Torah. We always daven using an Orthodox sitter. Yeah, I mean, we know this about Lieberman. We thank you, Rabbi Shunau. We had all, I mean, you knew him personally, right? We had all the classes on him. I just thought that, here we have new testimony about Susanna Heschel's bat mitzvah, that he wouldn't allow it and that he didn't hold of the Erev, the Manhattan Erev, which, again, this was an Orthodox Erev, but he didn't hold of it. This is says like Judah Benjamin. Well, Judah Benjamin is a Southerner. Judah Benjamin is, if you want to do a trick question, ask people, who's the first Jewish Secretary of State? And when they say Kissinger, say, no, Judah Benjamin. It's like on my tour when I ask people, who's the first Jewish mayor of New York City? So someone, they'll say Koch, and they'll say, no,
LaGuardia.
Say, no, LaGuardia. So Nissa knows it, LaGuardia. But very few people know that LaGuardia was actually halachically Jewish. But Judah Benjamin, yes, but he was he's not someone who we want to today with, when you think in terms of slavery, he's definitely not someone we want to invite. Although maybe we should do classes on it because, Bernard Illowy, student of the Chasam Sofer, one of the big Rabbanim in America, he, attacked the North for, persecuting the South. He was in the Confederacy. Morris Raphael, rabbi in New York, a B'nai Jeshurun, was Orthodox synagogue. He gave a sermon defending slavery, said that the way they did in the South was inappropriate because they were cruel. But the idea of slavery says, well, that's Holy Scripture. And David Einhorn, the Reform rabbi, attacked him. It's a little embarrassing today because we read it and we're more inclined to believe like Einhorn. But It's an interesting story. Eric says that Wilson resegregated the federal government. That's not going so far back. No, I agree. I agree. But I just, my concern is always how, you know, the recreation of putting our values back on them. And even Herod, for instance, wicked Herod, he had some good qualities. He was a good builder. He did a good things. That it's very tough to judge people from our generation. And I mean, that's part of the whole woke ideology, is trying to, you know, recreate the past in the present. And it's complicated because Wilson, they had different understandings. Wilson, I know Wilson's not so far back, and Wilson did things.
Even for his own time.
I understand, but he also had good qualities to him. Oh, yeah. So what are you going to do? You're going to, we have the president of Harvard. I don't know. I don't know what you're going to do here. It's an issue. Matt Mark says the Washington Monument honors the president, but doesn't bear much of a resemblance. Correct. That is correct. And David Fishman says the Moshe interpreted the murder appears or is exercised in first circuit division. Correct. On the passage, Toshin Rav Nagenim. But Schneer Lyman, in the volume published by the Harvard Center for Jewish Studies called Danzig, he has an article there because Tiferes Yisrael was the rabbi in Danzig on this whole issue, and he cites all the sources and where it comes from. It's an old Greek theme of the person with the evil character traits who's able to overcome his inclinations. This gets into the whole debate, which you have different opinions on either side. What's better? Is someone better who never has the inclination to sin, or is the Baal Tshuva better? We know B'mkom Shebaal Tshuva stands, even a Sadeh Gomer can't stand there. But then we have other passages that seem to have a different opinion. I had a teacher once in Israel who said, you know, the Pshat in place of Baal Tshuva stands, a Sadeh can't stand there, he says, because of the Reach. And that's a terrible thing to say, but that's what he said. And so you have different approaches to this.
Rambam, in the fifth of the Shmona Prakim, debates Aristo on that point and says, the Rambam, of course, says it's the one who's, you know, the self-made man who was Gover on his Yetzer, and of course, the Greek.
Well, it depends. It depends. He says that about ritual laws. So, for instance, you're supposed to say, well, this tarfus is good. I'd like to eat it. But Torah says I can't. But if you're not supposed to say I want to steal or murder.
It's the fifth of the Shmona Parakim where he specifically debates with Aristotle.
But he distinguishes. But if you say, for instance, that I have a great desire to murder or to rape this woman, but I overcome my inclination, that is not a positive thing. So he distinguishes. He makes a chiluk between the two. And HL says the monument to Judah Benjamin that was in Charlotte was removed in 2020. Monuments in Richmond, monuments, there's all sorts of monuments that some are still up, so you got to go. And Susanna says back in the 70s, nobody accepted the Eruv as far as I know. I don't know. I wasn't living in New York then. Maybe it's sort of like nobody in the 70s accepted Hebrew National. It was under Orthodox Hashgacha, but the Olam, as we say, didn't accept it. Rabbi Kelman, are you here? Okay, yeah. I usually give it to Rabbi Kelman. I just see his picture just went up, so maybe I had to do something. So I'll tell you all then, Rabbi Kelman's not here, so I will say that I thank you all for coming out tonight. We only have one more class before I break, because next week, and we're not going to finish next week. I need, I think, three more classes, because after that, I go to Florida. And
Professor Mark, Rabbi Kelman asked me to tell you that he is here. He just can't speak. His computer froze.
Okay. So I can't announce the various classes, the exciting and interesting classes as we get ready for Hanukkah. They're coming up as well as all the other classes, so you can look at the schedule. I'll only be here one more class. And then following that, the following Monday, Emir Hashem, I will be in Ma'arav HaPnimi. That's the way it's referred to in rabbinic literature, Morocco. And then I'll be in the UAE, and then I'll be in Eretz Yisrael, and God willing, I'll come back, and we'll pick up right where we left off. But we'll meet one more time. And thank you all again, and see you, God willing, next week. Good night, everyone.